Isaac Fitzgerald is a New York Times best-selling author and a frequent contributor to The Today Show, and it's hard not to be engaged by his energetic, enthusiastic delivery. Just listen to him speak with Today Show host, co-host, Hoda Kotb, a couple of months ago.
What is a good beach read? Define it for me.
Oh, for
you
me,
open it up and
you're
what?
On the beach, you're getting that summer sea breeze, the sand is in your toes, and it's something that just takes you away almost like a second vacation on your vacation.
But behind that bubbly persona, Fitzgerald lived a life that was at times full of abuse, suffering, loneliness, even suicidal thoughts. And in his new book, Dirtbag Massachusetts, A Confessional, he tells his story without any whitewashing. We connected with Isaac when he was in town earlier this week, and he told us more about his childhood.
It starts right here in Boston, and I was very fortunate, and that's the word I want to use. I was very fortunate to be involved with the Catholic Worker. So there used to be a soup kitchen down on Haley House. Eventually, my family and I make our way into the John Larry House, which is basically like a halfway home that the Catholic Worker was running. Those were some of the best years of my life.
But then, at the age of 8, his life changes forever, and not in a good way.
This is tough neighborhood, 80s, let's be honest. South End was a little bit different than maybe it is now. I think my family, for different reasons, decided that things were getting a little too tough. My mother and I move out to North Central Massachusetts.
So this is at 8 years old where you almost have a reverse Harry Potter moment.
That's an incredible way to put it, yeah.
And so you head out there, and then your life is just different.
It's completely different, and that's absolutely right. It was hard in the city, but it was filled with joy and love. The country felt very, very lonely, and it was very, very difficult. And I believe my mother was struggling with lots of different issues, including the fact that, you know, hindsight 2020, I can now see that this was a soft separation for my parents. I didn't know that at the time. But I basically became someone she leaned on. At the age of 8 years old, there was really nobody else for her to talk to.
And we're talking probably, whether diagnosed or not, severe depression, suicidal tendencies, thinking about self-harm.
That's completely correct. And actually acting some of this out. But again, when you're a child, you don't really understand that. You don't understand that you're maybe having a unique childhood. You don't understand that maybe not everybody else is going home to this exact same situation. So that's what the rest of the book is about. It took me years to figure that out. But it was about my childhood. And then it's about how I reacted to that childhood, most of which for years and years and years was denial. Oh, this isn't about that. This is about me finding my own way. And then it wasn't only, you know, I'm about to be 40, approaching, you know, late 30s. I start therapy, and it's about how I start to realize, no, everything I've been doing is in reaction to that. And really at the core of this book is about a family that explodes and in a very new, very unique, very different, yet still beautiful way, comes back together. Both of my parents had children. So I like to say we're more
before
of a,
you when they
yeah,
were in those
yeah,
other
yeah,
marriages.
Yeah, so I've got a half brother, half sister. I say we're more of a family shrub than a family tree. but my siblings now have children and our family is coming back together. So that's this book is about that childhood. It's about the ways that I reacted to it, but then it is also about how this family is finding a new way forward.
You talk about this family, the story of how a family explodes.
Yeah.
One of the things that's striking from the book is there's this family explosion and you realize at some point in your life, you think you were the bomb.
That's right.
And I don't know what it means to carry the idea that your entire existence destroyed things for people you love and the things you loved for those people.
For the longest time, if you had asked me, especially from when I was very young until not that long ago, I would say I was a mistake. That is how I viewed myself, and that is what I carried. And that was the story that I told myself, because that's the other thing this book is about. It's about how we can structure our lives around stories that we either learn or internalize or start to tell ourselves. And sometimes those stories can be really beneficial. They can be dreams that get us out of situations that actually make us go live a wonderful life. But they can also sometimes be stories that we're telling ourselves that belittle ourselves. And that's what I did for a very, very long time. I truly thought I was a mistake. And so, again, this isn't even in the book, and I obviously don't want to spoil the ending, But it's important to me that this book is not just a perfect present. It's not a perfect bow. It's not all wrapped up.
It's not.
No, exactly.
It's called Dirtbag Massachusetts.
It's an ongoing conversation. And so to that point, my mom has now read the book. My mother has read the book. And one of the things she said to me that instantaneously changed everything was, I had no idea you were carrying this.
Did she internalize that she in some ways wrote the book?
Yeah. I think she really, the more we talk about it, because we are having some of the best, most in-depth, most connected conversations that we've ever had, you know, maybe since I was far too young to be having some of them. But we're really reconnecting around this book. And I think part of it, what she's realizing, that this isn't my story, this isn't my book, this is our story. And she's very much at the heart of it.
I feel like listeners need to understand, if we're going to talk about this part, mm-hmm. they need to understand that there is a point in the book where you recount, once you've moved to Western Massachusetts, and we're going to come back to mm-hmm. that she says out loud to you, maybe I shouldn't have had you.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the journey from them to then to now with your mom.
Yeah.
Had she ever told you the opposite? I'm so glad I had you.
That's what's happening now. When she said, I had no idea you were carrying this, the line before that was, she said, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Which I think I'd been waiting to hear that my whole life. And I didn't even know it. But sometimes you hear the words and all of a sudden it unlocks so much.
Okay, so I'm going to sort of, like we're stipulating for the jury for a second.
Let's
I'm going to
do
sort
it.
Of stipulate
yes.
that when we talk about the adult portion of this journey, you go through a lot. There's a lot of alcohol use. You spend years living, working, thriving in bars. You participate in the porn industry at one point. There's a lot of drugs in your adolescence and early adulthood. I lay all of that out because we talked about the childhood part. We didn't talk about the adult part mm-hmm. as much. But we talk about the name of this book, which is Dirtbag Massachusetts. I've listened to some of the interviews. I've read the book. You don't really explain why you use the word dirtbag.
It's a great story, and I'd love to tell it right here.
Tell it.
Okay, so listen, bounced around the state quite a bit, lived different places, but where a core part of my younger years were spent after we got out of Boston, my teenage years were spent, I lived in a place called Athol, Massachusetts, out on Route 2. And I love it. It's right by the Quabbin Reservoir. It's absolutely beautiful. I want to be very clear about something. I'm incredibly proud of coming from Athol, Massachusetts. Now, the rest of the state, let's be honest, it was a low-income area in what is a very rich state. So that's part of this too. Class is very much a part of this book. But people would call it Rat Hole, Massachusetts. People would call it
Blink, blink, man.
Yeah, I was going to say, am I allowed to say it now?
No.
But we all know what, that's what I'm saying. We all know what I'm
rhymes
about to
with
say.
Other things.
Right, yeah. Turns out you can't call a book that either. I tried.
Got it.
But so I was driving up with my friend Jason Diamond, who is an incredible author in his own right. And we were having a discussion about how you can't call it Massachusetts. You can't call a book that. And we literally were staying in a motel, like in the shadow of Fenway. I'm not joking. He was doing this beautiful event. And he just, so casually, he didn't miss a beat. He just turned to me and said, why not Dirtbag Massachusetts? And that was it. I won't lie. At that point, 85% of the book hadn't even been written. Mm. But once I heard that, I knew that that was going to be a lodestar. That was going to be a guiding light to the stories that I wanted to tell.
Did you ever think you were a dirtbag?
Yeah. I still think I am. Let's be honest. That's, again, it's a messy book. This is not a book about, and now I've gotten all buttoned up, and now my life is on track. No, I think that's part of life. It's what I love. A lot of Catholicism is in this book. One of the things, don't get me wrong, there's parts of Catholicism, especially structured Catholicism, that I have issues with. But there's so many great lessons from Catholicism. And some of them are about forgiveness, and they're about meeting people where they are. And it's about allowing humans to be humans. We're messy. We are not perfect creatures, and that is something that is very important to me.
Good. So I want to really press on that a little bit.
Let's. Ah,
again,
I love
again. This. So you know, you are now known in your media appearances, etc., with this vibrant, loving, I think, bubbly personality, and there's this other guy who's in this book. So, for example, I've got the cover right here in front of me. It's my copy of it is yellow and black, and it's got somebody crossing their fingers like, cross my heart, hope to die, or like, I'm not really telling the truth, so I got my fingers crossed. Every time I would walk over to the book to read the next essay, I kept imagining that instead what should be on the cover was a middle finger instead of fingers crossed. Isn't there a middle finger dimension to this?
Oh, 100%. And I won't lie. I've never had that thought. That is a truly original thought. And thank you for sharing. Because truly, as much as I would have liked to have called it Massachusetts, maybe it should have been a middle finger and not the crossed fingers. But that's absolutely right. There is anger. There's anger in that book. And there's anger inside me, and it's something that I'm still grappling with, and it's something that I'm still trying to understand, if I'm being completely honest. And that's what therapy is for. That is something that has really opened up so many doors in the last few years of my life. And allowing myself, it's okay. It's okay to have that feeling. Sometimes I think a lot of emotions we're told they're not okay, so you have to turn them down. I've learned to become a little bit more accepting of the angry child that I was.
So we're talking with author Isaac Fitzgerald about his new book, Dirtbag Massachusetts, follows his journey from happiness in early childhood in Boston to, rough life in Athol, Massachusetts. Then we go to San Francisco, we go to New York, eventually we resettle in New England. And it is a no man's and every man's tale of the journey from a painful childhood to figuring out, you know, how to love who you are. Is that fair?
I mean, that's more than fair. That's the kindest thing. Like, it means so much to me that you actually read the book and that you so clearly connected with it, because you are clearly getting what I'm talking about. So sorry, that's more than fair. That's kind.
I'm glad, and I appreciate that, because as I read the book, I kept thinking, this cost him something. Mm. These are essays, right? I'm imagining you wrote them a little bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Did you pick, okay, now I'm ready to tackle X, now I'm ready to tackle Y? Did they tell you, no, now here's what we're going to do, you better write this one? Or was there something more coolly strategic about how you put this together?
No, when I sold this book, it wasn't supposed to be about my childhood at all.
Well, wait, what was it supposed to be?
I'm telling you. It was supposed to be just disparate essays about different pop culture things. My idea, and there are many writers who I admire who have done this. I was like, okay, I'm going to tackle Star Wars, and like maybe I'll touch on my father with my relationship. I'm going to tackle this and that. And there is still one essay in the book about the band The Hold Steady, who mean the world to me, and they're fantastic, and they're very much rooted in a lot of different places, but including Massachusetts. That essay was what it was all kind of supposed to be like.
Yep.
And every time I sat down to write an essay like that, I'd be like, all right, touch on the relationship with the father. Oh, no, wait, hang on. I got to explain this. Oh, no, wait, hang on. It got so away from me. I realized I'm trying to force myself to write a book that I don't need to write. The things that I'm having a hard time looking at, the things that are difficult to be open about, that's where the story is. And so it was only by trying to put these essays that are not in the book on paper that I found the essays that are in the collection. And I had to write an email to my editor that was like, so I know I pitched you this one thing, here's what I've got. And she was so encouraging, and she kept saying, yes, this is actually it, and keep going.
Any essay that's not in the book that you now wish was?
Mm. There's an essay that I've written, it was a while ago, about why I ended up in New York, that we basically felt was a little bit too explainy for what we were going for here, so we took that out. I still am very, very fond of that essay, and I do hope people get to read it at some point.
Have you published it elsewhere?
No. It's like...
So that's the one you'd like to put out there.
Keep it in the back pocket, yeah.
So there are so many other things that I want to talk to you about in the content of the book, the writing of the book. You talk about your father a couple of times just now. You've mentioned, okay, I'd write about this and think maybe I should write about my father. And one of the things you make a point of when you talk about a journey, and we missed this earlier... You talk about a journey where you were in Athol, which you don't name in the book.
I think I do mention it maybe like once, but yes, it's not driven home in any way. Yeah.
And then you wind up in a boarding school
in
your sort of later teen years. Yeah. And it's an all boys, you know, it's better contained than Lord of the Flies, right? And it's academically strong, but it's an all boys boarding school.
Real quick. All boys dorm.
Dorm.
It was actually a co-ed. God bless.
I didn't get that.
God bless. Yeah, don't get me wrong. When you're 14 and you move there, it feels all boys because you're just locked in a cement dorm building. But no, it is co-ed. But yes, my experience, especially in that first year, was very much an all boys experience.
And you got there because a woman in your life, in your community, saw the potential in you, a librarian, and offered to help you fill out the applications and stuff. And you go on to explicitly say at some point, I realized that there were women in my community who were seeing the pain I was in,
mm-hmm.
who were seeing, you never say from your childhood that there was a man who stood up for you or showed up for you.
I think there's something to be said for that for numerous reasons. But one, my story in my life has actually been about seeking out father figures. And it's really interesting to hear you say that because you're dead on. That's not in the book. But that is something I've done a lot. But that is not in the book. But women in the community that I was in, librarians, secretaries at the school that I worked at, people who, like my parents also, to be clear, but loved books, really helped me get out of these situations. And then I did spend the rest of my life looking for a father figure. And I've had wonderful relationships come out of that. I've had wonderful examples of what it means to be a good man. And one thing that's happening now is I am reconnecting, like, with my father.
You climbed a mountain with him.
I climbed a mountain. But even then, we, you know, you've read that as, even
yeah.
then,
you didn't
it's
really
not
talk.
Quite there. Yeah. But, like, we are figuring out a way forward because I now recognize the things that he experienced that maybe made him closed off to these conversations, which made me feel neglected. And so he reads the book, and so my mother writes, I'm sorry. I had no idea you were carrying this. My father, and I want to say this, I'm quite charmed by the man. He's very funny. He wrote back, I don't know what to tell you. Childhood's tough.
Okay, so this is the moment then where we're going to have you read a little bit.
Okay.
Okay, and this is from the essay called Maybe I Could Die This Way.
Yeah.
You're grappling with suicidal thoughts,
mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry about that.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
The undiagnosed mental illness that different family members of yours suffered from and how you weren't really able to talk about it with your family. We've just heard your dad being so deep, right? So read these couple paragraphs.
Here we go. When you can't talk about something, you're prevented from naming and describing it, from making it real. And what you can't name and describe and make real becomes infinite and limitless and impossible to decipher or resolve because it can expand to fill your whole life and self to its tiniest corners, or it can shrink to nothing. Nothing being the size of things that are not real. You are alone with it, with yourself, with this unsolvable problem.
Author Isaac Fitzgerald reading from his new book, Dirtbag, Massachusetts. And for listeners, if anyone is struggling with suicidal thoughts, the phone number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. So you did name it.
Yeah.
So now that it's real, what's possible for you that wasn't until you put this all on paper?
It's those conversations, not just with my parents, but with the rest of my family. It's watching my nephews and my niece and knowing that I'm going to be there for them, that I'm going to be able to support them as they grow older. And listen, like I said, nobody bats 1,000. Nobody's perfect. They're going to have their own hardships. But I know that I'll be just that much more able to communicate it. And that's what it comes back to with my father, too. His dad didn't talk to him about anything. My dad writes me an email. Yes, he says, hey, childhood's hard. But he also said, I mean, there are other jokes in there. Shouldn't have given you so much Bukowski to read as a young kid. That was hilarious. I mean, my parents did. They loved books. Like, that's why, in a way, I wrote a book to try and communicate with them. But the last thing my dad says in that email is, I'll see you at Thanksgiving. Because the whole family's going to get together. And we don't do that anymore. Back when I was a kid, people had to get driven around. Somebody's going to be here on this day. Somebody's going to be here on this day. Everyone was avoiding everyone. My siblings, now that they have the kids, everyone gets there on the day. Everyone either makes peace and sits down at the table or they're not invited. And it has been so beautiful to watch this family that had so many different issues figure them out, come back together, and be there for what's going to be the next generation.
So let's stay with manhood a bit longer.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going to describe you a little bit. Let's see, that's your left hand. You've got the word home tattooed across your fingers.
That's right.
Oh, and your right hand. Oh, come home. So it says come home when you look at it. You've
yeah.
got tattoos, some with Catholic themes, all up and down your forearms. You wear a tight shave on the sides of your head. You've got a mustache and beard. I bring all of this up because you have an essay in the book where you talk about barbershops.
Yep.
And you realize at some point that lots of different barbershops you've tried, the barbers say awful things to you. They say racist things. They say things that are about violence against women. At some point, they show you inappropriate pictures of other people who are racist or white supremacists. And at some point, you realize there's something about you that must be signaling that they think that's you, too.
That's right.
And it's part of a larger discussion in the book about all the ways that you see your body and feel good about it or don't.
But what's happening in that moment, and that's, I really think what we're coming to, and this is why I love talking about this book, because I get to see what people take from it. And what you and I are talking about so much while we're having this wonderful conversation is communication. I'm talking about communicating with my family in this new way that feels so good. But part of communication is also expressing, like you were saying earlier, when you're upset, when you're angry, when you don't want to abide by something. And for the longest time in those spaces, and not just the spaces of the barbershop, sometimes at school, sometimes growing up, I would keep my mouth shut. I wouldn't speak up. And I would let things that I knew in my heart I didn't agree with, I would let them slide because that felt easy, because that was my way to glide through life. And something I'm learning as I get older is what that takes away from me every time I stay quiet. You can learn how to communicate in wonderful ways with the people you care about. You can also learn how to communicate when you're uncomfortable, when you're upset. And that's something I wish I'd known a lot earlier.
So somewhere out there is a little boy in the anti-Harry Potter experience who is young and suffering. You know, Chris Siderick, the producer on this segment, and I were both thinking of Joel Christian Gill and his graphic novel Fights. We talked to him about it. And he told us he wrote about this traumatic childhood as a way to reach out to other young adolescents. So somewhere out there, there's a kid. And there's someone in their lives, maybe a woman and maybe in their case a man, who sees that they're hurting. What do you want them to do for that kid?
If this book can reach one person and can be a roadmap for them to get out of whatever rut they either find themselves in or maybe even mentally they are in on their own, that's the whole reason. That's the only reason to write something like this. I imagine this book as a soft cover folded up in a 14-year-old's back pocket because that's the book that I wish I had had. It feels grandiose even to speak it out loud. It's hard to express that, actually, but it's the truth. If I can hit one person with that where they read it and they say, hang on a second, I can figure out a few of these things a little quicker in myself, that will mean everything to me. One of my favorite lines, and I'm going to not say it word for word, but there's a play, History Boys, by, not going to remember the name, Alan something. Anyways, there's a line from the play History Boys. What's so special about reading is you can be sitting there looking, reading, and you'll come across a line or a thought or a moment or even an emotion that you think you only had. You yourself, you felt so lonely with it. And then you see it on the page and it's like a hand comes out and it grabs yours and you're no longer alone. Mm. If this book can do that for somebody, it will have been worth the 4, 8, 10, 20, however, it depends on when you think I started it, but maybe 30 years that it took me to write this book.
All right, so last question.
Hit me.
So now that 14-year-old you
has
this book in his back pocket.
Yeah.
He's read it.
Yeah.
What does he say to you today?
That 14-year-old boy, you know, he wouldn't say thank you because he's, you know, that's maybe something an older person would say, you know? But he would just say to me, I'm going to be more intentional in the way that I live my life. I realize that life is not just something I have to let happen to me. I can actually make decisions, learn how to communicate, get in touch with my own emotions, be okay with my own emotions and who I am. And I'm going to be more intentional in the way that I live my life.
That was Isaac Fitzgerald, frequent contributor on the Today Show and author of Dirtbag Massachusetts. Fitzgerald joined us here in Studio 2 earlier this week while he was in Boston for a book event. The playwright of the History Boys, by the way, Alan Bennett. And you can find a link to more info about Isaac's book on our website, radioboston.org. And again, if you or someone you love is experiencing a mental health crisis, you can call the new National Mental Health Hotline at 988. That number again is 988.